Here it is 9 o'clock.
Okay, it looks like we're 9 o'clock. I keep getting these different alerts in my Bluetooth. Anyhow, good morning and welcome to the Public Safety Committee meeting. Today's date is Monday, February 13th, 2023, and I'll call this meeting to order. And I also just want to let folks know who are joining us via web or telephonic, pursuant to Assembly Bill 361, we're still allowed to conduct this meeting via Zoom. And if you'd like to participate, the instructions are on the agenda along with the password. You can attend via Zoom and you can call in. So with that being said, I'd like to move on to our roll call, please.
Yes, good morning, committee members. Agua Caliente, Bandacuya Indians, City of Blythe,
Sure.
City of Cathedral City,
Here.
City of Coachella. I did hear that he is here. Yes. City of Desert Hot Springs,
Present.
City of Indian Wells, City of Indio,
Present.
City of La Quinta,
Present.
City of Palm Desert,
Present.
City of Palm Springs, City of Rancho Mirage. Councilmember Marker is present.
Oh, yep. Present.
There you go. County of Riverside.
Present.
And Torres Martinez, Desert Cuyah Indians. Chair, you have a quorum.
Great. So we'll move on next to our Pledge of the Flag. And if I can have everyone join us by standing and placing your right hand over your heart. Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All righty. We'll now move on to item A. And I want to take this time to recognize two of our fallen officers who we lost in tragic events recently, just weeks apart, and the end of December and January. Deputy Isaiah Cordero and Deputy Darnell Calhoun from the Riverside County Sheriff's Department, who were taken away from their families, their brothers and sisters at Riverside County Sheriff's Department, and our community. Deputy Cordero began his career with Riverside County Sheriff's Department in May of 2014, and most recently became a motorcycle officer September of 2022. Deputy Calhoun began his career with the San Diego Sheriff's Department before transferring over to Riverside County Sheriff's Department in February 2022. Both are survived by family, friends, partners, Riverside County Sheriff's Department. So I'd like to take this time and have a moment of silence in memory for these two fallen deputies in our community. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to move on to item number four, which are public comments on agenda items. And it's 3 minutes for public comment. Staff, do we have anyone for public comment?
Chair, we did not receive any written comments, and I don't see any hands raised at this time. But Chair, just for the record, I would like to acknowledge Mayor Gardner, City of Palm Springs, is now present.
Great. Good morning, Mayor. So now I'll move on to item number five, which are chair, committee members, and CVAC staff comments. And I'll go ahead and get us started by welcoming some of our new committee members. We have Coachella Councilmember Frank Figueroa, who's joining us. Welcome, Frank. We have Indian Wells Councilmember Dana Reed. Is Dana with us? No. We also have Rancho Mirage Council Member Meg Marker, who's with us. And we also have Torres Martinez, Desert Cahuilla Indians, Councilmember Desiree Franco, who's joining us. Welcome to our Public Safety Committee. Looking forward to working and collaborating with you all. I'll go ahead and continue my comments with, let me find my notes, sorry, with the City of Indio. And then I'll move along to some of my partners. Excuse me. There we go. So on January 3rd, we had a beam signing ceremony for our new public safety campus in the City of Indio, which will be located on Jackson and Dr. Carrion. It's right behind our current Station 86 and our police department. It's going to be a great new facility. It's going to consist of a dispatch center, a new fire station headquarters, and living quarters for our Station 86, administrative offices, and a new police department as well. And it's expected now to be operational before 2024. So they're moving along real fast. And that's good to hear. So that will be for our new public safety campus here in the City of Indio. And I do not have any further things to report from our city. Actually, I do. I'm sorry. I don't have the date on it, but recently, prior to our last meeting, this meeting, we had a traffic operation in our community, which was great. It was a multi-agency traffic operation in our city. And I just want to thank the agencies who participated in that. We've had a lot of issues with speeding and traffic in our community. And with our traffic light synchronization program getting ready to start, I hope that that's able to aid. I know this is a public safety committee, but along with working on the Transportation Commission and different committees, public safety and traffic kind of go together. And so while we're moving forward on our Monroe Bridge interchange, that's going to help us tremendously as far as public safety in our city. And, you know, especially during the festivals, and I don't want to say just during the festivals, because our city has grown so much north of the I-10 freeway. And so it's become a challenge. Traffic has become a challenge in our city. And oftentimes when folks can't get to places, they begin to speed and take alternative dangerous routes. And so that's been an issue in our community. So I just want to thank our Indio Police Department and the supporting agencies who were part of that operation. I don't think the mission was to write tickets. It was more so to educate on the dangers of traffic in our community. So thank you. And if there's anyone else who has comments from our committee members, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll call on you. Mayor Pro Tem, Cantania.
Good morning, everyone. I wanted to first thank our law enforcement partners. We had our 5K and half marathon this weekend, a very successful event. And during that time, I had the opportunity to speak with one of our I think he used to be in special forces and now he got moved to a different division. And I followed up on a comment that was brought before this committee some time ago about the traffic circles, the donuts that are done in the intersections. And he shared that when they find them and they're able to get them through the license plate readers, they issue a $500 felony vandalism charge. So that is hopefully something that's done as a deterrent. I've got the $500 from a different note on here. So the $500 is actually because we still have our rebate program going on. If any of our businesses in Palm Desert choose to install a new camera system or upgrade, the city will give them a $500 credit. And part of the conversation regarding the donuts and the traffic circles, we did talk about the fact that the rise in vehicle crime has been difficult to manage because a lot of them are stolen plates from throughout the county or outside of the county, and that they rent the vehicles from independent mom and shop places so that it's a little more difficult to trace. So, you know, just something to toss out there as we're going to analyze the crime in the area. So that is all I have to report. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the report. Do we have anyone else who would like to report from the committee? Nothing since the last meeting. Come on now. Erica?
Chair, I'll defer to committee members first. Otherwise, I did want to note that this is, and for those of you who serve on multiple CVAG committees, you may have noticed this in your agenda. This is CVAG's 50th anniversary. It's a big deal, a big milestone, and it speaks a lot to regional collaboration and the efforts of our member jurisdictions to come together on regional issues. And you will be hearing more of that throughout the year, including at our General Assembly in June. And I also just wanted to echo the chair's welcome to our new members. Thank you, Chair.
Great, thank you. And before we move on, I just want to say happy Black History Month to everyone on this February. Great, and do we have anyone else? Oh, we got Mr. Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Erica, just a quick question. This will be our last Zoom meeting. After this, we are in person, is that correct?
Chair and committee members, that is likely. That is something that we will be coordinating with the chair of the executive committee. There are some varying opinions on AB 361. The legislation actually goes through this calendar year, and we have received some legal guidance on this. Your next meeting is not until May. The Public Safety Committee typically goes dark in both March and April, acknowledging that our law enforcement is very busy on the weekends with these little festivals in the city of Indio. And so by then we will have some more firm details. So I would expect that we will follow up with you on exact meeting logistics. And that was probably a long-winded way of saying very likely, but not for sure.
Thank you.
All righty. Do we have any other reports from any of the committee members? All right. So then we'll move on to item number 6, which is ex officio updates. Staff, do we have anyone with their hands raised in ex officios?
Chair, I don't see any hands raised at this time. We do have a number of our chiefs who are preparing to talk for an item later in the agenda.
Great. So we'll stand fast until that item. So we'll move on to item number 7, which is approval of the November 14, 2022 Public Safety Committee minutes meeting. If no one like to have any changes to those minutes, I will entertain a motion.
Move approval, Cathedral City.
I second that, Paul Desert.
Okay, I have a motion by Cathedral City and a second by Palm Desert. Could I have a raise of hands and eyes for approved? Right, any nays? Got one nay? Oh, no? Okay. How about it? Any abstentions? We got one so far. Okay, so with one abstention from Councilmember Figueroa, this item does pass. Okay, so we'll move on to item number 8, which is discussion and action items. So the first item is item number A, which is an update on the looming closure of the Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. We will have a presentation by the California Department of Corrections. And as a chair, I will be recusing myself from this item and passing this on because of a potential conflict, being that I'm still employed by California Department of Corrections. So I will be moved, I believe, to the audience, and I will stand by.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair, and good morning, everyone. This is item 8A, and it is as has been already stated, it is an update on the closure of Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. So I will ask Erica Felci if she would start us off with the staff report and introduce our speakers.
Yes, thank you, committee members. This item was asked to be brought to you by the City of Blythe. In December, the state announced the process was starting to close Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. We have a map we're going to show you just real briefly here, give you a sense of the proximity to the city. And on the next slide, you'll see kind of an aerial shot of the size of the facility. With us, we do have a number of representatives from the California Department of Corrections, including prison closure manager Charles Callion. So thank you very much for joining us. And I know that David Maldonado is also on the line, who graciously helped me with making sure we could get everybody's schedules in order for today's meeting. It's staff recommendation that you all receive a presentation from the state and then have some discussion. I know the city of Blythe has asked for a position on this, and after, but I would recommend that we first hear from the state. Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Callahan and Mr. Maldonado. Mr. Callahan, I guess we'll turn it over to you to start us off and lead your discussion.
Good morning, and thank you. And again, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to discuss our progress on the prison closure project. You know, I always get nervous when I do these kind of things, and I can't figure out if I'm more nervous during a Zoom meeting or actually talking in person. So please bear with me. So again, my name is Charles Callahan. I'm the former warden and chief deputy warden from Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. I ultimately retired as the deputy director in late 2021 for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I'm currently working as the prison closure manager. And as stated, it has been announced that Chuckawalla Valley State Prison is planned for closure in March of 2025. Simultaneously, we have announced closures of California City, which I also worked at, and then facilities at California Institution for Men, California Rehabilitative Center, the prison in Tehachapi, California Correctional Institution. California Men's Colony will be closing three facilities, and Pelican Bay State Prison will be closing one facility, and then we'll move on to the California City March 31st of 2024, and then ultimately Chuckawalla Valley State Prison in March of 2025. So the process that the state of California and Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation used was we followed the Penal Code 2067 when selecting the institutions for closure. Understanding that no matter which prison we close, it's a difficult decision. There's a lot of factors involved, and the fact that it touches our employees in the community, it makes the decision even tougher. But again, we follow the guidelines as set forth in Penal Code 2067 to include cost to operate an institution at the new capacity, impact to staff, public safety, rehabilitation of the inmate population, and so on and so forth. So for those of you that don't know the layout of Chuckawalla, it has five facilities, four within the electrified fence, within the secure perimeter. Each of those facilities houses level two non-designated programming inmates. Each facility has three buildings on it. And there's approximately in the high 400s per yard on each of those facilities. There's approximately 870 budget positions at that institution, with approximately 750 of those positions being filled. So I know a big concern is what's going to happen with the staff at Chuckawalla. So we're actively working on our facilities that are closest to closure, which would be CRC, I hate to use acronyms, California Rehabilitation Center, and California Institution for Men. And we're looking at their staffing needs, and we're going to use the same process throughout that we have used at Dual Vocational Institution and our prison in Susanville. We're going to go through a process of allowing staff to voluntarily transfer to other institutions where there is currently vacancies. We're going to use that process through an interactive process with the employees, whether it be through town halls or individual meetings. And we're going to engage with staff to see how we can help facilitate our staff to maintain employment. We you know, it's it takes a lot of work and a lot of engagement. And, you know, we've already looked at some of the dynamics with the staff at Chuckawalla and Ironwood, too, because they're so closely situated. You know, there is a high percentage of staff. And when I say high, somewhere between 50 and 60 of staff that actually work at Chuckawalla and Ironwood that do not live in the City of Blythe. They live in surrounding areas like Imperial County, Indio, Coachella, all the way to San Diego, Los Angeles, all over the place. So there will be opportunities for these staff to actually get placed closer to home in many cases. So, you know, again, we're going to engage with staff at an early stage. We're also going to attempt to do what we call a delayed lateral transfer. So once staff can finally figure out where they're going to go work, we like to hold them back so that we can safely operate the institution at a safe level of staffing, and the staff member will know where they're going to end up, and they'll know the date when they're going to arrive at their new location. But it allows us to do two things. It allows us to secure employment for the staff there, and it allows us to safely program the inmates that are currently housed at Chuckawalla. As far as the inmate population goes, you know, there's many institutions where these inmates will be transferred to. And at each one of those institutions, there's a robust education and vocational education program at each of these locations. There's also college programs. There's substance abuse training and classes. There's self-help. Every institution has great programs. I've worked at many of them. And I actually started in education at the beginning of my career and worked my way up in a different direction. But so we're very, very good at moving inmates around the state. We've done it for years and years and years. We have a excellent transportation team and a population management unit that is very good at doing that. So we don't anticipate any issues with that. And then as far as what's going to happen to the buildings at Chuckawalla, once the inmates are out and once we establish a warm shutdown team, which generally what a warm shutdown team means is we leave a team of plant operations staff back to maintain electrical, HVAC, the plumbing, the overall maintenance of the institution for a couple of years, which at that time, the structures will be turned over to Department of General Services to see if there's any other interests out there where they may be able to reuse the building for something else from another agency or government entity. So there will be some services that remain at Chuckawalla to help service Ironwood State Prison, and that would be wastewater and water treatment. That would be the fire department, and it would also include the garage, which is physically located on Chuckawalla's grounds, but they repair and maintain the vehicles as part of Ironwood State Prison's fleet. So there will be some staff remaining back, but those are all located on the outside of the institution, on the institution perimeter. So regarding the Blythe economic investment, I know that we have a team that is actually working, that will be working with the City of Blythe regarding that. Is there anybody on the line here that would like to speak to that?
He's not a panelist right now. He is, I asked if he was on. It's Javier Romero.
We can move him, David. We will move him over right now. Thank you.
Also, I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but I did live in the City of Blythe from 2013 to I moved away in 2020. So I know the City of Blythe a little bit just from living there. And for a while, they were raising my children and them attending the high school there at Palo Verde High School. So I'm a little familiar with the town in case there's any question to me on that.
Sir, Javier is now... has audio and video. He can join us for the conversation.
Good morning. I am the Deputy Director of the EDD Workforce Services Branch. My name is Javier Romero. And I'm here to share, as Charles described, some of the resources that are available in the community directly to the City of Blythe. Right now, my branch is the administrator of the Community Economic Resilience Fund, which is currently in the planning phase. So it's $5 million in the area. That's the Blythe is included, which is for planning purposes. So any representatives that we could connect with, we'd be glad to. But what's more, probably more interesting would be in the fall, there will be available $500 million statewide to support what we call implementation grants. Any kind of actions, that have been identified to support economic development, that funding will be available to support, that job growth. And in the interim as well, EDD is also the administrator, what we call, I don't know if you're familiar with the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act, the WIOA. That fund is basically administered locally through 45 local boards. There's one in Riverside. We support each of the local boards, including Riverside, what we call rapid response. It's really intended to support plant closures such as what's scheduled to occur. But we do an additional theme with it, with that fund. We have this thing called additional assistance, in which we support often studies or planning purposes. We had an investment up north in support of Susanville, in which we're supporting that community to do some analysis as to just to get a firm understanding of the impact, not only the immediate jobs losses within that prison that's closed, but also the impact on the community. And also we support the connecting members of that community to kind of be a seed, any planning to and connect them to other resources in the community. So those are opportunities that we could partner with Blythe in your region to put you in connection to further any kind of studies on economic impact, any planning or organizing you would like to the community, and to position the community in response to the closure.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And Mr. Callahan, do you have anyone else that you wish to have speak?
No, sir. I did want to give you all an opportunity. If you had any questions for me, feel free. If I know the answer, I will.
All right. Yeah. Please stay on the line. I believe we will. All right. Next, I'd like to call upon, if he's ready, our committee member from Blythe, Johnny Rodriguez, and to see if you have comments or questions.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Callahan. Thank you, Mr. Royal, for your comments. With me is my interim city manager, Mallory Garcia. She'll be also asking some questions, perhaps. Mr. Callahan, looking at the penal code that directed this closure, it was supposed to be, the name of the facility is supposed to be announced in January of 22. Were you in on that decision of the naming of the facility at that time?
No, I was not.
Do you know when Chuckawalla was actually named? What date?
I do not know the exact date. When it was announced, I was retired. But I believe it was possibly sometime in December.
Okay. Yeah, that's when the former secretary that retired 2 days later announced it. Okay. So we just wanted to know how long this was sitting on the table before engagement began. Also, just through our analysis, what we looked at, it seemed like CRC would have been a better fit. But it sounds like you were given this assignment after the selection was made. So if I'm sure if you can answer some of those questions, that would be great. If not, I understand.
Can you tell me what the specific question was? I'm sorry.
Why CRC, which was identified in 2012 by Governor Brown for closure, but at that time you guys weren't meeting the state cap or the federal mandated cap at 137, so it stayed online. It was funded to stay online until 2016, which again, he wanted to close it, but again, the state wasn't meeting the percentage. So it was, I believe, $800 million was funded for other facilities to build housing facilities to basically match CRC's capacity, and so they could stay at the 137. But then once again, it was not closed. Do you have any information to that?
Right. So I am a little bit familiar with that, but I was, you know, I wasn't around during when they decided to not close CRC. But I will tell you that we are closing the facility A at CRC, which is the seven-story building that we have continually had some fire watch issues there, a very expensive building to operate. And now that luckily statewide our population is down, we're able to do that at that location. But I was not part of the decision making on which prison or which yard. But as you know, the statewide population is down considerably from where it was even 5 years ago. Chuckawalla's population was about 1,100 inmates, higher than it currently stands today. And that's just not a Chuckawalla population decrease. It's really throughout the state of California, really the last 10 years, but mostly over the last 5 years, there's been a significant decrease. And what I used to talk about is, you know, back in the old days, you know, an institution normally housed about 4,000 inmates. And when you look at our statewide population going down even $20,000, that's about five prisons. And so we're not there anymore. You know, populations are well below the 137.5% statewide. So I don't know if that helps answer any questions or not, but I retired in December of 2021. I volunteered actually to work on this prison closure project because, I'll be honest with you, a lot of the staff at Chuckawalla are my friends, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can to assist them with employment placement. And, again, I think I mentioned I was the acting warden at California City. So we're going to do everything we can as a department. I'm personally involved with this. And, you know, it's a tough decision, Mr. Rodriguez. It really is. And, so I don't know if that answers any questions, but that's where I'm at on it.
No, I appreciate your sentiment. We asked for a number of documents to public records release, and we're still waiting for quite a few. Or do you have that ability to expedite those or to look into it?
Yeah, I'm not sure who's working on that. I'm guessing it's our Public Records Act unit. I do not have the answer to that, though.
Okay. We'd be happy to follow up, though, to see where they're at and make sure that they're on track to get it to you.
Thank you. And hi, Charles. It's nice to see you again. A number of our requests have also been denied. One substantial request is information related to the penal code that you cited for reasons for closure, one of which is cost to operate. So if we could get that information, it would really help us maybe understand why Chuckawalla was chosen. Earlier, Vice Mayor Rodriguez mentioned CRC, and we understand based on an LAO report that it's going to cost $1.1 billion to improve that facility and bring it up to operational standards, whereas the investment needs at Chuckawalla is $430 million, so still quite significant, but much less than what CRC would cost to continue to operate. So a lot of this just doesn't really make sense to us why CVSP, one of the newer institutions in the state system, was chosen over a prison that was built in the 1920s. So any information you could help assist us with just figuring out how Chuckawalla was selected would be greatly appreciated.
You bet.
My next question, Mr. Romero. The $500 million you mentioned that could come to this county that we could apply for, is that open to any commercial interest, private and whatnot?
No, the grantee would have to be somebody that's set up to receive federal funds, and where our grantee pool is a nonprofit, so it could be a CBO, an education entity, a workforce entity. And so a nonprofit is a very broad spectrum of possibilities. So that's who could apply. It won't go to individuals or businesses per se.
Okay. And how's that working out for Susanville so far? What's been allocated out there?
For Susanville, they haven't received any SURF funds, but they have received additional assistance funds. We've made up to $1 million available to them recently, and we haven't seen the outcome of their activities yet. It was awarded to them, I believe it was in November or December. So, I haven't seen it yet. I mean, if there's somebody in your community that's interested, I could put you in contact with not only your local board, but also the local board in Susanville to kind of share some of the things that they're doing with that funding or exploring to do or even struggling with.
Any questions? Thank you.
All right.
No more questions.
Thank you. So let me ask a question while we're on the topic of funding. If anyone else on the committee has a question on that, if you'd raise your hand. But Mr. Romero or Mr. Callahan, maybe you can answer. So as Mr. Romero, as you're going through the list of the funding, the resilience fund or resiliency fund, and then the $500 million, I keep hearing the word planning. So are these funds available just for local agencies, or as you're saying now, nonprofits to do planning activities, or are there other mitigation activities that are eligible for this funding?
Right now, there's two phases to the SURF fund. Currently, we are in the planning phase, and that's to run through the fall next year. Some regions will go a little longer, but soon thereafter, funding will be available for implementation. And the purpose of the planning, the way it's set up is that one is that we require what we call an inclusive table. And not only business representation, but also community representation. And the whole goal is that it's, an equitable strategy that's derived from there. And then the plans can be as broad, but the expectation is that the whole identified region is supported by that planning. And then thereafter, any portion of their plan could be then executed upon with implementation grants. And there will be, and I apologize, don't have the set number top, like $500 million will be divided amongst the 13 regions, which are part of the Inland Empire. And basically that, and I couldn't tell you what that universe is right now. I should know that, but I don't. Off the top of my head, I could share that information later. So like I said, planning phase currently, fall, early winter, will be the implementation phase. And there's expected that execution will result in job growth and job opportunities for individuals.
So is there history anywhere in the state of what types of implementation funding the state has made for other facilities that have either partially or fully closed?
You know who would be best? Because we are the administrating entity, being the EDD. I could talk to GoBiz, in which has let's just say that they've had more experience in this realm of economic development. I'm more on the workforce, kind of call it the supply side. And GoBiz, though, could probably provide you some examples of projects that have occurred in the state. They're the ones that basically support what we call our local EDAs. And they work with the federal government to support those EDAs. So we really see a linkage between workforce and that infrastructure or something similar to that kind of coming together for this resilient fund. Long-winded answer. I don't have an example for you currently, but I could get you contact with somebody that can.
Vice Chair?
Yes.
Vice Chair, I can work with their staff to get some answers on that question and circle back with the committee.
Well, because I think what we're digging at is it's great to talk about planning and we may be able to do something. Well, what kinds of things are we talking about? You may be able to do, what have you done in the past? What are you anticipating? I know you're not going to, can't be exact without the planning, because the planning will direct what then you'll try to implement it. But I mean, what are we talking about? So if you don't have that, then I guess if you could work with our staff to try to get that, that would be very helpful.
Yes, we'll give you examples just to illustrate the possibilities. And thank you, Erica.
All right, committee. Anyone else have questions while we have our presenters from CDC here? And I'll go back to Blythe first, and then we'll go to Palm Desert.
Mr. Callahan, was there any, since you're the shutdown crew or the planning, is there any planning for secondary use or new use of this facility? And my question is directed, will it be considered for a federal prison since they are in need of infrastructure?
So I don't have the answer to that. I think that's certainly a possibility. Again, kind of after the couple of year warm shutdown process, or possibly sooner when Department of General Services ultimately takes over the facility, I think if they're interested in doing that, they're more than welcome to contact DDS and engage in those conversations. I am not familiar with the federal population or anything like that, whether it's up or down or really what they're doing. I do know that, you know, the California city is a leased property, and we leased it from Core Civic, which I believe they used to in the old days, used to house federal inmates there. But if that happens, then obviously that would be wonderful for the city of Blythe. And it's kind of already set up for it. So if they have those kind of population needs, then I think that would be a win-win for them, certainly. But I personally, and to my knowledge, the department is not engaged with any other entity on the use of that facility.
And because they're the two facilities, because they share infrastructure, from our viewpoint, it'll be very difficult to bring any other industry in there since they're going to be so close to another prison. You know, you go with your safety of different people close to a prison operating, and then the relationship with the water, all the maintenance, the laundry, all that has to be ran out of Chuckawalla and then delivered to Ironwood. So that's another reason why we wonder why, since he has such a relationship, a symbolic relationship, why it was chosen to shut down over a prison that does not affect another prison in the same manner. But like you said, you were not in on the decision, but that's one of the questions we have, why it was selected.
I understand.
All right, let's entertain a question from committee member Quintanilla. I see you have your hand raised. You're still on mute.
Thank you for the reminder. I have found that the discussion has been robust, and I think that there's a lot of excellent questions that have been raised by the City of Blythe. And I think given though, although we are not in immediate proximity, I think these things do impact us, do impact our public safety. And I honestly would like a copy of that information as well. For those of us that are not familiar with that penal code, I think that would be very helpful. We know that crime trends will go up and they will go down. And right now we may see a lower population of inmates, but I believe that we need to be aware of that. Now, one of the things that were mentioned in terms of the distribution of where inmates will be, if there will be a closure of Tehachapi and Pelican Bay and all of these different facilities, how will you determine where these inmates will be distributed? And is there a plan to have some of them go to private prisons? What is the cost per inmate of having someone in a private facility versus a public facility? And then I also wanted to go back to when you mentioned a warm closure and maintaining the upkeep before it is offered to other entities. What other entities have utilized these opportunities in the past? I know that federal was mentioned, but if a federal agency does not choose to come in to bring federal inmates, what other types of facilities or organizers or anybody that would come in and seek that facility?
Let me try to answer that maybe in the order that they were asked. I believe that your first question was, where will the inmates go? The inmates will be transferred to other locations that house inmates with similar case factors. You know, we have an entire classification services unit that looks at case factors. They look at programming. They look at their classification score. They look at their documented enemies at other locations. And we transfer the inmates to where they can safely be housed consistent with their custody level and classification concerns. These inmates could go to other locations that are similarly situated, other level two, non-designated. There's basically plenty of space out there. And we don't anticipate any drawbacks to that. Again, we're doing the same thing at Tehachapi. You know, there's approximately 1,000 inmates at that yard where they're going to be transferring out. At California Institution for Men, we're going to be transferring about 200 inmates out and absorbing about 800 inmates on other facilities. California Rehabilitation Center, they have approximately 500 or so inmates on their facility A, which is the 7-story structure that they will basically just be absorbed on other yards at that location. So, you know, the inmate safety is certainly a top concern about the location where they go to, but there's plenty of locations where we can transfer these inmates. Can you remind me what your next question was?
Sure thing. How many of these inmates do you anticipate could potentially be put into private facilities? And as a follow-up, what is the cost per inmate at a California facility versus a private facility?
None of these inmates will be transferred to a private facility. In fact, I believe California City is our last non-state-owned institution. So the only caveat to that is inmates that are lower level that meet the criteria, they may be placed in a male community reentry program, which we've had for years and years and years. And, you know, Chuckawalla, along with other institutions, have been pretty successful about filling these locations up. I believe there's 3 in Los Angeles, 1 or 2 in San Diego, Bakersfield and Butte County. I mean, they're kind of all over, but there will be no change to that process. An inmate qualifies to be out at an MCRP unit, then they'll go regardless of what institution they're from. So, no, we will not be opening up or transferring these inmates to a private prison.
Wonderful. I appreciate that information. Off the top of your head, would you happen to know what the cost per inmate is for the state versus a private prison?
I do not know the cost of that.
Okay. And then one other question was in terms of the mention of if these facilities stay as a warm facility and they are offered for someone to take them over, what types of entities have taken those opportunities? You mentioned federal, but what other entities have taken over similar shutdowns or experienced situations like this?
Back in approximately 2021, when we closed down dual vocational institution, to my knowledge, they are still in the warm shutdown process, and the plant staff are still there maintaining most of the facility. But to my knowledge, there has not been an entity that has taken or expressed interest in that. I mean, I've heard rumors, but I really don't want to speak to rumors about, you know, the different type of people that have, you know, that people have thought about what to do with these facilities. But, you know, it's real early with Chuckawalla. You know, I 2 years just seems like a lifetime away, although I know it's going to come up on us very soon. But, you know, I mean, it'd be great for the state of California if somebody did come along and express interest in any of those locations, whether it be DVI, Susanville, CCC in Susanville, or Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. And I know Mr. Rodriguez mentioned, you know, that it would be hard to do it. I honestly think that, you know, there's water there. I mean, there's fire department there. There's things. And, you know, the fire department does do mutual aid out on the local freeways. They're out there all the time, and that'll continue. The fire department supports Ironwood State Prison and those type of things will go. But I don't know. I hope something comes along that they're interested in using in the facility. It might not be one of our oldest institutions, but it is the oldest in the desert, you know, compared to Ironwood State Prison and Calipatria and Sentinella State Prison, which I also worked at for about 12 years. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
it definitely does. It does.
In the interest of time, we should probably move on. We do have questions from another committee member. If you have nothing pressing directly pertaining to the closure,
I did have one follow-up question, and that can be a separate report. What is the annual cost or monthly cost of maintaining the warm?
I do not have those dollar figures. I can tell you back when I was at Chuckawalla that the plant operations annual allotment was between $1 million and $1.5 million, but that did not include utilities, water costs, anything like that, strictly for basic maintenance.
And I believe City of Blythe said that's part of what they've asked for and haven't received. So hopefully if that comes to them, we can all see that.
Great.
All right. Committee Member Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just a quick question. I know that there's public input when they're siting prisons in various locations. Is there public input when they're closing prisons?
Who wants to take that? Mr. Callahan, the process for closing, do you know if there's public input for that?
I do not know.
Just for the committee's information, there was none. The announcement was made. It was forwarded to the staff through the warden, and it trickled out to the community. The next day, it came out in an email. Or actually, it didn't come out in an email. It was posted on CDCR's website.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Are there any other questions of our CDC guests before we then talk about possible committee action? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and ask Erica if you could please excuse our guests. Thank you again, Mr. Callahan, Mr. Romero, and Mr. Maldonado for joining us and for sharing with us. And perhaps we'll have opportunity to ask you to come see us again sometime in the near future.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to throw this back to Blythe, if you would, because I know you were the one that made the request to have this on the agenda. What is your request of this committee?
Go ahead.
Yes, so we've reached out to all of our legislators, our representatives, the County of Riverside. We're just asking for support. We are working with the City of Norco to propose a swap of Chuckawalla for CRC located in Norco. They are very supportive of that. Their community has wanted that prison closed for a number of years. It was built as a resort property and hotel, and they'd really like it to be redeveloped into that until that building is so far gone that they are not able to do so. So we're just really looking for support as we continue to work with Assemblyman Garcia, our newly elected state senator, Steve Padilla, and our other local elected officials. We do have a lobbyist that we're working with and also a PR firm. Be on the lookout for Save Chuck, the website and plan that we are launching to hopefully change course of the closure of CDSP.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, committee, do you have any questions of Blythe or any suggestions? For the sake of time, I will offer a motion if we're ready for discussion. That's okay. All right. I would move that we ask the executive committee to direct the executive director and CVAG staff to assist Blythe in their request to re-examine and reconsider the closure of Chuckawalla Valley State Prison. And if that closure appears it's going to move forward, that we push for the repurposing of the facility and meaningful mitigation of the local effects.
Desert Hot Springs, second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion. All right, seeing no discussion, I'll ask for a roll call vote if we could.
Chair, you don't need a roll call. You can just ask for anyone voting aye.
Waving hands. All right.
Yes, waving hands.
All right. Please wave your hand and or state aye if you agree.
Aye.
Any opposed? We have one opposed. Any abstentions? Looks like the motion carries. Thank you so much, Eric. If you'll bring the chair back, I'll gladly turn the meeting back over to him.
Thank you, Vice Chair. We are bringing him back in. Much appreciated for stepping in there.
Anytime.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Vice Chair, for handling that item for me. And I appreciate the robust conversation. However, in the interest of time, I'd like to ask the committee if we have item number C, which is a roundtable discussion for Coachella Valley crime trends. I'd like to ask if we could continue that item until the next meeting so we could have a robust conversation about the asylum seekers in the Coachella Valley. So I'd like to request that item C be continued. And if I can have a motion and a vote for that, I would entertain that now.
Mr. Mayor, I would make the motion that we carry to the next meeting if possible. It's an important conversation I think we should have. So.
I'll second that motion.
Deputy for City Seconds.
Okay, I have a motion on the floor to continue item C and a second. Could I get a show of hands for ayes? Any nays? Abstentions? So staff, it looks like we'll continue that next item so we can have a robust conversation on item number B. Letter B, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair. And just for the ex officios who were in attendance today, thank you. We'll reach back out to you for that item in May. And Chair, we do have Jeff here for item B.
Okay, and item B is Riverside County's Coordinator Response to Asylum Seekers. Mr. Jeff Imogenin, Riverside County's Executive Officer, is with us now. Floor is yours, Jeff. Welcome.
Chair, thank you for the welcome. And committee, it's good to see all of you again. The purpose of today's briefing is really three parts. One, to provide a brief update on the status of the county's humanitarian response to the surge in asylum seekers, identify two challenges that we see on the horizon, one just weeks away and one a couple of months away. And then number three, share with you the three asks that we have been making with our federal and state elected officials. First then, a brief update on our humanitarian response. And before I jump into it, I just want to thank Erica for the summary and the packet. It's a very, very good one. So I will simply supplement the information that is included in your packet. Every day for the last 677 days, we have coordinated with United States Customs and Border Protection, the state of California, county departments, and nonprofits to receive and care for individuals and families who are being released from Customs and Border Protection custody pending their asylum hearings. We are only one of three counties in California to be participating in this program, and we're the only non-border county. Some have asked why we're involved in this program. It's simply because we have three CBP stations or Border Patrol stations within our jurisdiction. While we're on the topic of Border Patrol, I just want to note, and I know often there are members of the ad hoc group that from Border Patrol, I just want to say that CBP has been an extraordinary partner from the beginning, and I believe that we have as a strong relationship locally as there is anywhere in the country, if not the strongest. I want to thank our partners with CBP, especially the teams at our Border Patrol stations in Blythe, Indio, and Murrieta. Once CBP makes the determination that they've got to release the asylum seekers, they coordinate with our emergency management department the time of the release and how many. They also give us a heads up of what is we can expect the next day. Those asylum seekers, when they are released from custody and they are transferred to us when we receive them, they're given medical and mental health screenings. They're fed, they're housed, typically for less than 2 days. While our nonprofit partners work with each individual or family to identify either their family, friends, or a sponsor where they can stay while they wait for their hearing. As of last night, again, day 677, we have received 66,752 individuals who have come to the United States from countries across the world. Here in Riverside County, the top five countries of origin have been Cuba, Brazil, Colombia, Peru, and Venezuela. The vast majority of the folks end up somewhere other than Riverside County for their hearings. Less than 1% have remained in Riverside County awaiting their hearing. Through most of the response, and you can tell by those numbers, we've received roughly 100 people per day. We saw that number begin to increase in September, and it peaked in late December. It began to increase in September and peaked in late December at approximately 300 people per day. That was because Title 42, the ending of Title 42, appeared imminent. When we see 300 people a day, which is what we saw throughout the month of December, that is close to our maximum capacity. We get asked what happens when we hit capacity and we can't accept any more from CBP. Put simply, there are, quote, street releases, and that's exactly what it sounds like. Border Patrol releases those seeking asylum directly on the street. Of our 677 days, that's only happened twice, once on December 24th and once on December 26th. A total of 129 people were released on the street. There are lots of reasons for that anomaly. One, the increasing numbers that landed in a time when there were holiday closures with some partners in other counties. There were winter storms in the Midwest that you'll remember, and Southwest Airlines melted down. So the system, which is in a delicate balance, crumbled, and we had 2 days of street releases. But it gave us a sense of what could happen in the future and what we're concerned about. So what are the two challenges that we see on the horizon? Currently, the state of California pays the cost of the medical and mental health screenings, and they pay the cost of the motel rooms. For an idea of what those costs are, just to house the people each month, it costs $1.3 million to house these folks for 1 month in county motels. The state has been able to pay those costs and then seek FEMA reimbursement from the federal government because the state's been in the COVID emergency. As we know, that ends later this month. We're concerned that the state cannot or will not cover costs moving forward. The second challenge we see is directly related also to the end of the COVID-19 emergency, specifically the impact that would have on Title 42. Currently, our numbers have dipped back down to roughly 100 a day. And part of the reason why that dip happened is because Title 42 was kept in place by the United States Supreme Court, which has had the effect of reducing border crossings and then ultimately the releases coming out of CBP. It's also partly because the state has set up what they're describing as a soft-sided facility in San Diego to increase the capacity of San Diego to accept folks. We're told that while the numbers crossing the Southwest border are low, and that's across the border, the numbers of individuals and families that are waiting in Mexico to cross the border remains high. The operational assumption from CBP and from the county is that people are waiting to cross when Title 42 is lifted. When that happens, we've been told that we can expect our daily numbers to triple, if not more. Again, that would put our balanced system on the brink of collapse. So what are we asking from our state leaders and our federal leaders? Number one, we need 100% FEMA reimbursement in real time for the anticipated level of response post-Title 42. Anybody who's been through an emergency knows that FEMA pays typically only a portion of your expenses, and the delay in getting those funds can be months, if not years. So we are lobbying to get 100% FEMA funding, either to the state and then to us or directly to us. Number two, we want those medical and mental health screenings to be conducted by CBP before this population is released in Riverside County. That would reduce both the workload, the number of folks we need to be involved in this, and the cost. And then finally, and really most importantly for this discussion, we want other counties in California and beyond to be involved in receiving CBP drop-offs before there is a single street release in Riverside County. Like I said, we are one of three counties in California that are engaged in this effort. That means 55 counties are not receiving drop-offs from CBP. We want to make sure that before there's ever again another street release of an individual, that we have expanded this effort elsewhere across the state to avoid folks landing on the street. So that is the briefing, and I know that you wanted to have a robust discussion, so I'm available for any questions, comments, concerns, whatever from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wagenen, for your update. There's a lot of information, but thank you. It really irons out some of the things that were floating around, and to hear from you. What I'd like to do is ask any of the ex officio members if they have any questions or comments before I move to the committee.
Chair, I don't see any hands raised at this time.
No hand raised. Okay, so.
Your chief from the city of Indio just raised his hand, and we'll move him into panelist mode.
Okay. Okay. Chief Washburn, whenever you're ready, the floor is yours, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Good morning, Jeff. So as you're aware, with only a few Border Patrol stations and Indio being one of them, our concern really is largely humanitarian. If in July and August people are dropped off at our bus station, we have no place to house them, no place to shelter them. And as you know, when the federal government chose to do this, in typical federal government fashion, they started doing it on December 24th, knowing that our ability to respond politically would be very limited. That's probably an editorial comment more than anything. So whether we get any assistance with the federal government or not remains to be seen. The question is, do you see a role that the county can have in assisting with that humanitarian effort?
Yes. And Chief, thanks for the question. Also, thank you for your partnership for the rest of the committee's well-being. Whenever there is a change in development with this program, I update each of your city managers. Bruce Barton, our Director of Emergency Management, will update your emergency services. And we also try and make sure that law enforcement is looped in. And on those days in late December, I know that I was having lots of conversations with the city manager and some even with Chief Washburn. Our goal is to have zero street releases anywhere in the county. So everything we're trying to do is make sure that we are given all of the resources we need to continue the response. And the day that there, the 2 days that there were those two street drop-offs, our folks were scrambling to try and get other nonprofits and faith-based organizations mobilized to try and provide services to those individuals that were dropped off either at the bus station or at the airport. But Chief, absolutely, our goal is to make sure that there aren't any folks, let alone 50 or 60 or more folks just dropped off in the city of Indio. We recognize that this is a burden across the county. And certainly no city is able to handle these drop-offs. And for greater context, I'll tell you what happened when San Diego had drop-offs. Within 2 days, their homeless shelters were at capacity, and they were unable to receive additional homeless folks at their shelters. So this really is, and Chief used the word humanitarian crisis. That has been our posture from day one. Because if these folks are not received by us, if they're not cared for and fed and housed by us, they're wandering the streets with no assistance, no help. They certainly could become victims of crime. They could, in some cases, become perpetrators of crime. And in other cases, simply be added to the homeless population in our communities. None of those three is acceptable.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for that question, Chief. Do you have any more questions for Jeff before we move on?
No, thank you very much.
Right. Thank you. Staff, do we have anyone else in ex officio with their hands raised?
Chair, I don't see any at this time. If anyone does, we will move them in. But if you want to, for the sake of time, continue on with member comments, we can come back.
Absolutely. Anyone from the committee have any questions or comments for Jeff? Please raise your hand. I do have Vice Chair Gregory with his hands raised.
Yeah, I just quickly want to, of course, thank the county for what they've done and what they are continuing to do, and for bringing this issue again to our attention. It sounds, as has been shared, that there is a precarious balance right now, but it is very scary looking at us as to what would happen. I guess I would ask Mr. Van Wagenen, so these ones that did get dropped off on the 24th and the 26th of December, do you know, were they provided by the federal government any resources, or were they just dropped on the street and they had to basically fend for their own in our own communities?
My understanding is that they were not given, you know, in terms of resources, they weren't given medical or mental health screening. They weren't given food. They weren't given housing. I do know that the federal government tries to drop off individuals and street releases at or near a transportation hub. Which in essence is great if you have the wherewithal or the means to then use that transportation hub to get to some further location. And that's for us where the nonprofits come in. We're able to have the nonprofits meet with individuals in their hotel rooms to identify those folks so that they can move them on. When that doesn't happen, again, individuals and families are left to their own devices to try and move on. So in terms of traditional resources, no. I know the federal government does, try to drop them off near hubs, but if you don't have money, if you don't have a place to go, that's not all that helpful.
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, I think you're and everyone's been hitting it right. This is a humanitarian crisis, you know, really for these poor people that are getting dropped off, it's scary to think that that could start to be a daily thing or even magnified, that these people are dropped off with no resources and in our communities, because of course we're going to reach out and try to help as much as we can. So thank you again for bringing this to our attention. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll move over to Mayor Gardner with her hand raised.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your work on this. I know that in Palm Springs, we were scrambling on Christmas Day to help the folks that were at our airport. There were so many, and I know our chief was on the line, first notified us of that. And we were bringing food to the airport. We were connecting them to different services and trying to coordinate. And so that's been one of the biggest That was the biggest issue for us that day, was it was a scramble. There were people who had airline tickets for 3 days later. And not just, and these were, you know, one family in particular, it was two little girls with their mother and father. I mean, were they going to stay in the airport for 3 days before their flight? I mean, so we were able, as far as I understand, able to get all of the folks that were had multiple days waits to some other location for housing, but it really was difficult. So any efforts that can connect us all and make it easier for us to make a call to get assistance would be helpful.
Thank you, Mayor. We will.
All right. Thank you, Mayor Gardner. You know, in the interest of time, I want to move forward, but I just like to ask staff if they could continue to update this body on the progress of resources from our federal government and our county, how those conversations are happening, and how could we as local electeds help in that effort? And also, how can we advocate to the state of California that more counties need to be involved in this humanitarian effort, because our resources in Riverside County, San Bernardino County, and I believe San Diego, correct? Imperial, are being exhausted. So I really believe that other counties need to step up to the plate as well, because a lot of these folks will come to our communities and they will work, they will pay taxes in our counties. And so I believe that the other counties need to be stepping up. So I'd like to just see how we could help in that effort, if staff could keep us advised of those efforts in communication with the federal government and our county.
Will do. Thanks, Chair.
All righty. So thank you, Mr. Van Wagenen, for your report. There's a lot of information, but really, really good, important information that we needed to hear from the county. So thank you for joining us. All right. So we will now move on to item number 9. And that is an information item, and that is your attendance record, which is in your packet. And so I'll move on to item number 10, which are public comments on non-agenda items. Do we have any public comments?
Chair, we did not receive any written comments, and I don't see any hands raised at this time.
All righty. So now we'll move on to item 11, which are announcements. Our next upcoming meeting for the Public Safety Committee will be Monday, May 8th, 2023 at 9 a.m. We're not sure if that's going to be in person or virtual, but I'm pretty sure we'll be notified of that. And our next executive committee meeting will be Monday, February 27th, 2023 at 4:30, and that will be a Zoom. Before we conclude this meeting, does anyone have any other follow-up comments or questions before they get on about their day? All righty. So I'd like to adjourn this meeting in the memory of Deputy Calhoun and Deputy Cordero, who were taken away from their family and our community. May they rest in peace. This meeting is adjourned at 10:14 a.m. Thank you.